Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In our world of stacked store shelves, rationing is a seldom heard and pretty discouraging word. But my guest today says, get used to it. It's always been with us one way or another, and it's going to be a big part of our future, he says. On a crowded, changing planet, we're going to have to husband our water, energy, food, and medical care, he says, and markets alone won't get us there. This hour on Point, the dread word, rationing. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Do you buy it? A rationed future? Is it your worst nightmare? Could we have to do it? Could it save our bacon? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Say, rationing in your mind may go back to, I don't know, World War II England. Here's an advertisement that ran in Britain during the war, World War II. Here's Minister of Food, William Morrison, explaining to Britons how the government-run rationing worked during the days that Winston Churchill would call Britain's finest hour.
These little books may seem a bit complicated at first, but their purpose is quite simple. They mean that if, in the course of the war, we are short for a time of this or that article of food, rationing will give everyone, rich and poor alike, an equal share of all that's going.
Wartime Britain and rationing. Joining me now from Wichita, Kansas, is Stan Cox. He's a researcher at the Land Institute, a nonprofit that works to develop sustainable farming systems. His new book is Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Rationing. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stan Cox, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you again, Tom.
I'm sure a lot of people will just hear the word and say, you've got to be kidding. What do you mean, Stan?
Well, that's largely the reason I wrote the book. When you hear people objecting to new environmental regulations or universal health care or getting control of our carbon emissions, they generally use the word rationing as a scare tactic. Well, if we do any of those things, we're going to end up with rationing without really defining it or recognizing the many ways in which we ration anyway. And my purpose was largely to say, rationing, is that really the worst case scenario? What about global ecological breakdown or some other threats that could be a lot worse than rationing? So I tried to look at examples from the past and the present of when we have rationed and proposals that some have made for rationing in the future.
So let's get to the sort of heart of your argument, and I guess it is that global ecological breakdown is something, as you see it, that we are on track for now, and that what rationing would come either to try to avoid it or to deal with it when, I guess not when and if in your view, but when it comes, Stan. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's important to say at the outset that rationing isn't kind of a tool that can be plugged in to fix the economy or fix our overconsumption, but rather it's going to be something that we may find is necessary if we do manage to get control of consumption, which is now certainly out of control. If you look at our humanity's ecological footprint, that is our consumption of resources and generation of waste, destruction of ecosystems, it's about twice what the planet can handle with its carrying capacity. In other words, we would need two planets to continue going the way we're going. And that that kind of impact is distributed very in a very distorted way around the world to get down to what we could handle as the average person's footprint on the planet, we would have to have a reduction in our use of resources and impact on the planet for per person in America by about 80. We'd have to reduce it 80%, Europeans by about 60%. The average person in India could more or less double her impact and be within the limit that we would have to achieve.
You're talking about reducing what by 80%? Emissions, carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, that's a big part of it. It would be, yes, carbon emissions, pollution, generation of chemicals that are harmful, impact on biodiversity, all of the ways in which in supplying ourselves with both necessities and luxuries that we degrade the ecosystems that are our life support system.
So I want to be sure I understand. When you say there's too much overconsumption, that consumption is out of control, and then you talk about an 80% reduction, are you talking about, through rationing or other means, an 80% reduction in what might be described as the standard of living?
Right. Yeah. First, what we would have to have is a ceiling on a national budget, you might say, and we can use fossil fuel consumption as an example. There would be a hard ceiling, no trading away or offsets or anything, and we would have to say we're going to live within that budget. And once you do that, then you have problems with a lot of money chasing less fuel. So there's inflation. There would be a need to control the price to make sure everybody has what they need. And then as you see in wartime, there would be shortages and long lines and so forth, like we've seen in the past in gas stations. And so rationing would eventually become necessary under these scenarios. And we would but at the same time, we would have to be developing more efficient technologies and ways of doing more with less. So it wouldn't necessarily be a proportional decrease in the standard of living. It's kind of like we'd be in the situation of a wartime economy, but instead of all of our or a very large portion of our production being going off to Europe or the Pacific, it would have to be devoted to rebuilding our infrastructure for generating renewable energy, for changing our living and working patterns so we don't have an insane commuting environment, and all of the things we need to do to build an economy that can go on long into the future. Once those resources are all devoted to that, that leaves us an even more limited pie to slice up, and we need to do it in a humane and organized way so everyone has sufficient amounts of what they need.
Stan, you describe that in such a matter-of-fact fashion, and I understand, having read, how you come to these conclusions, but you know, the very idea is anathema to a lot of people, and politically, it's been a kind of third rail, to say the least. I mean, it's just not something that politicians want to talk about. Are you imagining that there's some crisis that forces a recognition that this is required, or that there would be political leadership which would say, we don't want to fry the planet, so we're all going to, you know, get ration cards and deal with less? How do we get to – how might the country ever get to this point you're describing, if ever?
Well, things can change very quickly. We just this week got the news that the Earth's atmosphere has gone over 400 parts per million carbon dioxide, and so that is obviously not going to be the event in itself that suddenly tells people we have to reduce our consumption.
First time in 3 million years, I'm reading here, that we hit that. It was just 24 hours. We'll see. But back then, the Pliocene era, sea levels may have been 60 to 80 feet higher than they are now. So who knows what's coming? Okay, that gets your attention. But I don't see people rationing their lifestyle all of a sudden as a result.
Well, it is an interesting question. What is going to get people's attention? For a brief time there after Hurricane Sandy last winter, it looked like maybe, even President Obama mentioned in his State of the Union address that we can ignore this drip, drip, drip of news about rising CO2 levels, but nobody can ignore the power of these mega storms. If we start experiencing the kind of pressure from these kind of events that, say, the people in the Philippines have lived with for decades, if we start feeling that in this country, that might be what does it. If our efforts, for example, to shut down the insanity in the tar sands in Canada and to stop hydraulic fracturing and restrict the supply of natural gas in this country. If those kind of efforts succeed and we do have a dwindling supply of fossil fuels, that's another case in which people would rather see a fair shares sort of approach than making everything go on our ability to pay.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about global sustainability and a prediction that we are headed for a world of rationing. My guest is Stan Cox. He's a plant breeder at the Land Institute in Kansas. His new book is Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Rationing. He joins us today from Wichita, Kansas. Stan, we've got callers for you. Daniel in Hartford, Connecticut. Daniel's calling. You're on the air, Daniel. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Hi.
Hi.
So, I see where the speaker's coming from. I just feel like he's understating to a very large degree the degree to which we could actually improve our lifestyles by reducing CO2 emissions. So I'm stuck in traffic right now getting to work, and if we had public transit, we could use far less CO2. I could actually get to work faster. So I think it's actually not people who consume things like cars who need to worry. I think it's more like investors who want to sell us more and more cars. They need to worry about how they're going to still make a profit while we actually improve our lives while reducing consumption.
Daniel, I think you're lined right up with Stan Cox. Stan, let me bring it to you. I mean, Stan, you make this argument that it will be a better life, but it will certainly be a very different life that you describe. You talk about the economy going from a growth basis to a degrowth basis, people working less, people having fewer material goods but having better lives. Is that what you see coming in a world of rationing, Stan?
Yes, that's exactly right. There's a lot of research now supporting the so-called Easterlin paradox that says rising incomes and increasing wealth do not bring an increase in happiness, and that's seen in many countries around the world. And one of the reasons for that is that our absolute standard of living, our ability to consume, is not what makes us happy. We compare that with others' ability to consume. And so if our income goes up $1,000 in a year, but everyone we know, their income goes up the same amount, we have a keeping up with the Joneses situation, and nobody's happy. So as Daniel says, if we start building the kind of society, the physical underpinnings of society that allow us to get by on less energy, we'll certainly, I think, be happier. But It's not going to happen automatically. We have to make that decision and devote a large share of our resources to building that.
You say that we're already engaged in a lot of rationing. Describe how that happens and describe the evolution of rationing that you anticipate or that I guess you'd like to see in this century, Stan.
Well, economists don't all use the term rationing the same way, but in some textbooks and among many economists, they talk about the rationing function of price, and that resources go to those willing and able, and I emphasize able, to pay the most for getting them. And so that's how, for example, we have situations like with the South American grain quinoa, which everyone now in this country regards as an excellent, nutritious health food. But we in America have bid up the price of quinoa on the world market so that now there's a problem with malnutrition in quinoa-growing areas in Bolivia where the people living there are no longer able to pay the price of quinoa and having to eat inferior and less food.
So the problem with letting the market sort out the distribution of resources, let's say in the United States, in this century would be what?
Well, When economists back in the 70s during the energy crisis did the math, they found that the price system, if you have a high degree of equality in a society of income and wealth, then the price system works pretty well for most things. Now, I don't know if you have a limit on all of your resources, it might not, but it does sort of fictitious country where there's a very high degree of equality. But of course, what we've got in this country and around the world now is festering inequality that's actually getting worse. And under those conditions, they found the price system does not ensure that everyone gets what they need and that having at least some form of non-price rationing is necessary to do that.
So how would you see this rolling out? And can you imagine a time when this country politically would accept it? I mean, you say yourself, it's sort of like shouting an obscenity in church. To move from keeping up with the Joneses to your chapter title is slowing down with the Joneses. That is a reversal of the American dynamic that has dominated more or less forever in this country.
Well, yes, you're pointing out making a good point there that in the past when we have rationed, it was to deal with a situation of absolute scarcity. There was only so much of something. How do we deal with a situation in which there is a lot of something, say fossil fuel, but we need to leave it in the ground for a longer time and slow down our extraction of that. And there are concrete proposals for doing that. For some reason, they all seem to come out of Britain, out of the United Kingdom, and they generally involve setting a national carbon budget. This is for rationing of carbon emissions, setting an overall carbon budget. And then every person in Britain receives an equal share of the carbon budget and can then and then they have a very sort of streamlined system, or they would if they were to pass this law, that you would have a card which when you buy gas, instead of swiping your credit card and your loyalty card, the second card would be a ration card, which would deduct certain number of credits from your carbon account. When you pay your utility bill, you would have to deduct carbon credits from your account as well, and everybody would be playing by the same rules. Now, a lot of those systems involve a mechanism by which if you run out of credits, you can buy them out of a general internal carbon market and those kind of things.
How long do you think the author of that bill, if it were ever to be passed, would stay in office in this country, Stan?
Well, again, I think we're going to be living in a very different world before long. And I agree with you that it's this preemptive restraint is a much harder thing to convince people of than the kind of restraint that's required, say, during wartime or during the oil embargo of the 70s when rationing was quite popular. It's not talked about a lot, but polls both in the 1970s and in the 40s were very much in favor of rationing and stronger forms of rationing as well.
Once the crunch hits, you mean people want to see some fairness. But in advance of the crunch, it's hard to get people to think about it.
Right. And so I'm book is sort of an exploratory operation here to see if people can be convinced of the need for restraint before it's a panic situation.
Before it's calamitous. Stan Cox is yelling the obscenity in church. In this case, it is rationing. His book is Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Rationing. Chris is calling from Manchester, Vermont. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey there. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm up here in Vermont where I moved to dramatically reduce my energy, live without a car, use a bicycle a whole lot. There are a lot of people up here who share my sort of attitude that we've got to cut down on our carbon footprint. But I think it's the wrong approach to take to equate global warming and solution of the climate change problem with rationing. I think you're sending the wrong signal politically to the American people, and people who are really going to be smart about it realize that you've got a strong intellectual basis there, but equating the solution of global warming to rationing is a total turnoff. And there are probably a lot of people who may even be listening to this show right now, and they may just turn it off when they hear the word rationing because it's such a turnoff. I mean, it goes back to World War II and a lot of other things. I would propose, on the other hand, a much more focused attempt to educate people, which is already happening to a tremendous degree on college campuses. I believe that global warming and climate change will be the political issue of this decade on campuses and around the world with the proper leadership. And Barack Obama has already really done the major single thing in a very subtle way, really, by raising fuel economy standards up to, 55, 60 miles a gallon. You're going to have – that's the largest single thing that the federal government right now could do to cut down on greenhouse gases.
Hey, Chris, stand by right there if you would. I want to get this to Stan. Maybe you'll come back here, Chris. But Stan, how about it? Chris says you are not a first-class political consultant. You're going to freak everybody out, and it's the wrong approach, and you should be describing more subtle steps that people can take. And don't get everyone all riled up talking about rationing. What are you doing, Stan?
Well, Chris is right that it's an inflammatory word, and that's the reason. And people told me when I was writing the book, they said don't use that word. But the problem is that it will get used, and if we do manage to push ahead to.
But why? Why not just say turn the thermostat down a little, turn your lights off, ride a bike once in a while, and we'll be fine.
Well, I devote a fair bit of the book to the problems with simply calling for voluntary restraint, which almost never achieves what it's meant to achieve. Whereas having explicit limits on what we're going to consume has in the past, and I think it would again creates a feeling of fair burden sharing, fair sharing of what abundance we do have, and everybody playing by the same rules.
You just don't think it's going to be enough unless there's what sort of a mandate: thou shalt have less of this and that.
Right. That's how it has, and I give lots of examples in the book, how it has always happened, whether it's in municipalities that are going through a drought needing to ration water, which we do a lot. Voluntary systems never work. Mandatory systems do work. Where if you Google rationing if you do a search for rationing on the web, in the news category, most of the mentions of it are going to be in healthcare, and that's another area in which and that's where that original quote about shouting in obscenity in church came from, the realm of medical care.
Well, we saw how hot that was. We saw how very, very hot that was around the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare debate. Chris in Vermont, how about it? Maybe you're kidding yourself. I mean,
rationing,
Stan Cox.
Rationing is a poison word, and Exxon must be loving this show, I'm telling you. Because what we've got to talk about is lifestyle change and resource allocation. Very simple concepts, but we don't need to be talking about rationing to solve the climate change problem.
But Stan Cox says, you know what? Our entire growth economy is not going to be sustainable. We have to change to a degrowth economy. That's just radical any way you slice it, isn't it, Chris?
I'd say that's pretty radical. But what I'm saying is, first of all, the United States public, compared to the rest of the world right now, public opinion in the U.S. is less aware and less accepting, even after the storms last year and everything else, global warming than the rest of the world. Other countries like Europe, Japan, Asia, even Africa, South America, other countries have a much higher percentage of people acknowledging the problems of global warming than we do here in the United States. So we have a political problem, as you pointed out, Tom, that has to be resolved before we can even have this broad-scale discussion of options.
Chris, I got it. I got you loud and clear. Stan Cox says there's not time. Others won't even accept his fundamental premise of the environmental damage that's coming down on us. But he's there, and he says, sorry, there's just not time for that. Let's go. Michael in Cookeville, Tennessee. Michael, we just got a minute before the break. What do you say?
Yeah, hi, Tom. As your guest has pointed out, we do have implicit rationing by price. And as the price of things go higher and fewer people can afford them, we're going to have some sort of explicit rationing. And in the future, the winners are going to be people who have educated themselves to be self-sufficient as much as possible. You can grow fruits and vegetables in containers, even if you live in an apartment, container gardening. You can learn about passive solar home design. There's books, there's websites. You can build a zero-energy house. And yeah, it'll be more expensive, but with no energy bill, it'll be cheaper from the day you move in. The government is not going to bring us solutions. Business is not going to bring us solutions. And people who educate themselves to be as little dependent on the system that doesn't want change are going to be the ones who are better off in the future.
Michael, I appreciate your call. Stan Cox says it's coming. We're going to hear a prognosis of abundance when we come back from the break. Stan Cox's new book is Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Rationing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about global sustainability and a prediction that we are headed for a world of rationing. Stan Cox is with us from Wichita, Kansas, author of Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Rationing. We have form of it already with the market, he says, but we've got much more explicit rationing coming down the pike. Response online to you, Stan. Lisa says, rationing will be a far more humane way to face the world of resource depletion. We're not only facing climate change, we're running out of every non-renewable resource. Growth has become a religion in the world. It's time we look at a steady state economics. But Eric writes, Stanley says, the argument being made here is ridiculous and unhelpful. Environmental conservation and cutting fossil fuel does not mean slowing down the economy. It just means we have to shift how we work, take trains or bicycles instead of automobiles, use software instead of heavy machinery. This conversation plays into the oil companies' fear-mongering we're all going to have to live like paupers, Stan.
Yes, that, well, I think Linda's got the better view on that. The problem is that the nibbling around the edges with more fuel-efficient cars and this kind of thing just it actually feeds the kind of growth that that we don't need. When cars are more efficient, that's the same as gas being cheaper, and people are tempted to drive more. Our prodigious ability to develop energy-consuming technology can always outstrip our ability to develop energy-conserving technology, and the economic incentives are on the side of consumption. And despite the claims that we can dematerialize the economy and do everything with electrons and photons, the reality is that we always see improving efficiency going hand in hand with increasing consumption of resources, because efficiency is an economic stimulus. It makes it cheaper to consume and more profitable to produce. And without some external restraint, the result is always increasing throughput of the economy.
Stan Cox says we're headed for trouble. Bring on the rationing, and it may be less deep trouble than it might otherwise be, but it's going to come one way or another, he says in his new book, Any Way You Slice It. Stan, please stand by in Wichita. I want to welcome Stephen Kotler into our conversation, journalist, co-author with Peter Diamandis of the book Abundance, New York Times bestseller, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. Stephen Kotler, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine, and I'm just curious how you look at this. You know, we saw Stan's book, and he's a smart and well-intentioned man. He knows very well that the word rationing is not a popular word in this country, shouting an obscenity in a church, he says. But his view of the future at first blush seems, diametrically opposite from the one you're laying out with Peter in your book Abundance. I mean, you say technology has the potential to significantly raise the basic standards of living for every man, woman, and child on the planet. Abundance for all is actually within our grasp. So which is it, Stephen? Are we headed into kind of climactic climate change doom where we've got to change our ways fundamentally to survive, or headed into abundance and it's okay?
Well, first of all, for clarification purposes, I think Stan and myself and Peter are in agreement on the vast majority of kind of the prognosis. We kind of, in abundance, we openly acknowledge kind of the devastating slide that we're currently on. The loss of biodiversity goes on and on, peak everything you could imagine.
Yeah.
These are not, made up conditions. This is the world that we're living in. What we are saying in abundance, the way you described it was the kind of techno-utopianist version, which is technology is progressing really, really quickly, and it's going to solve all our problems. That is not what we're saying.
I'm just quoting you. I'm just quoting the book. That's all.
Yeah, no, I know. And I want to just expand a little
on
it. All we're saying in abundance is there are four emerging forces, one of which is exponentially increasing technology. The other three are kind of human-based market forces that are emerging right now in the world that give us the opportunity to solve all these grand challenges. We're saying there are solutions emerging that are viable, but we're not saying it's automatic. We're saying it's going to take the largest cooperative effort in history. And in this, I think Stan and I are also in agreement. What he's talking about with rationing to me seems like a level of top-down enforced cooperation. We don't like the term rationing. Fine, call it enforced cooperation. But he's saying we're a global planet. Some of our resources are limited. Let's cap those and share those. And that's great. I've got no – if that's how you want to enforce that, that's no problem. What you have to also understand, though, is that opens up huge windows for innovation, and certain technologies, especially information-based technologies, are on exponential growth curves. They're adhering to Moore's Law or, you know, even faster. And this gives us tremendous amount of leverage in some of these categories. So rationing is one solution. Peter and I are saying, hey, these forces and these technologies give us a lot of leverage. Let's put our attention there. But I think both of us are saying we got to get our butts off the couch and do something.
You're talking about a do-it-yourself revolution, lots of backyard tinkerers jumping in with nanotechnology and robotics and everything else. You're talking about techno-philanthropists, Bill Gates and other big ones. You're talking about the bottom billion on the planet stepping up with all kinds of new innovation. But Stephen Kotler, I read you and Peter Diamandis as sort of coming out of the techno-libertarian school that wouldn't go for rationing, that wouldn't go for top-down controls. But you're saying that may also be required, you think?
I don't know if it's going to be required or not, but I like the idea of, I think we have a horrible, you know, as everybody this morning has pointed out, we've got a terrible PR problem when it comes to kind of environmental excess. It doesn't really matter how we phrase it, the message is not getting through.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons the message doesn't get through is because it never comes with a solution. And I like the idea of saying, hey, look, this is what our energy budget is for the world right now. Let's cap it, let's share it, and let's try to innovate around this problem. Because we can innovate around this problem. Solar right now is on an exponential growth curve. So a lot of the things Stan is talking about come back to energy and, you know, different ways of approaching energy. If we move off fossil fuels and start putting all that energy into solar, something that's already accelerating exponentially, I think that's a tremendous amount of leverage. And I think it gets us out ahead of what everybody, I think, agrees are pretty, you know, nightmarish problems.
That's a kind of a Silicon Valley argument. Tinker with the structure here to encourage innovation, and off we go. A kind of rationing, but in order to encourage new innovation. Don in Whetstone, Kentucky. Don, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering what we're to do with individual liberty in this situation. What do we ration? Do we ration how much land a person's allowed to own? How many miles you're allowed to drive per year? And then furthermore, who decides? Who decides what this number is? And who enforces it?
Thank you, Don. Stan, I'll give you that. The framing there is individual liberty. That's a deep American root.
That's right. And my answer is that we need to decide on those limits and what's being limited in a democratic way and not let it be decided now by big corporations that we don't have any control over. It would obviously be a very kind of contentious, to say the least, political process, but I think it can be done. It has been done in the past and with strong popular support, and I really like what Stephen was saying as well. I think he's right. We're in basic agreement about a great deal of this, and he was sort of echoing the godfather of ecological economics, Herman Daly, who has made what I think is probably the most important point here, that technological efficiency is great, and we need it desperately. We need to get really good at it. But that what Daly calls the efficiency first approach does not work, because that makes us feel that it's less necessary to exercise restraint. Whereas what he calls the frugality first approach or the restraint first approach makes efficiency more necessary, because we need to then, once we have those limits, as Stephen says, work out the best ways to deal with it to gain as much sufficiency and satisfaction from what we do as we can, given those limits.
Stan, I feel a reluctance to go to this place, but I think we have to go back to Don's question about liberty. You go right to big corporations and their influence. Certainly it is enormous. But there is also just a deep political, popular view in this country that goes for liberty over restraint. What do you do with that conflict in your on your runway here, Stan?
Well, it's not going to be easy, and certainly, as I said at the beginning, just plugging in rationing as a solution into the kind of economic system we have now is simply not going to work. We have a deeply unjust and unfair economic system, and we need a complete transformation and a redistribution of economic power in this country. And people have now have the illusion that we're rugged individualist and so forth, but it's all in the currency of money. And if you don't have that, then you don't really have power in this economy. And having a democratic control over how we use our resources rather than the corporate control we have now is going to be absolutely necessary.
Stephen Kotler, how do you see that? A political system overhauled in order to cope with the resource restraints that you and Stan seem to agree we're headed toward?
You have to remember what I'm not saying resource restraints. I'm saying, yeah, we have a limited amount of oil and gas. If we can produce technology that, you know, we get 5,000 more times energy in an hour from the sun than we use in a year. So a little bit more is going to get us very, very far. So I'm not necessarily certain rationing is an end result. I'm saying establishing some top-down limits and giving ourselves some parameters to work with is smart. That's forward thinking. That's worth doing. And do I think, you know, current capitalistic democratic systems are going to kind of survive this transition? I don't think anybody thinks they're going to survive, you know, what's coming now. You have corporations that are more powerful than nation states. That's a peculiar world we're living in. It doesn't look, you know, it's not going to look like it looked last century. So is there big change coming? Yeah, of course there's big change coming. Do I think it's going to happen one way or another? I think the individual is now empowered more than ever. So if you're talking personal freedom, I think Stan is kind of wrong with the money argument at this point. At this point, there is a lot of intellectual capital to be had on the web with ideas, with images, with other. Information technologies have allowed us to democratize huge swatches of society and give people a whole lot of individual power where they've never had it before. And today, in terms of, you know, DIY innovation, which you brought up earlier, mm-hmm. you've got individuals who today have the power at their fingertips that 10, 15 years ago was the sole power province of large corporations or governments.
But what are they going to do with it? Stan talks about a degrowth economy emerging to succeed a growth economy. What about you?
Let's take a real world example. MIT runs a synthetic biology competition called the iGEM competition. And it's basically take these fundamental tools of synthetic biology, which is progressing now at five times the speed of Moore's Law, and build new organisms. So this could be new foods, new critters, new whatever. And in the beginning, it was, let's take, you know, glow-in-the-dark genes out of jellyfish and put them into cats, and we've got glow-in-the-dark cats, and isn't that neat? In 2008, the winning team was a group of high school students working on mostly used equipment, by the way, that they got secondhand in Slovenia, who came up with a vaccine against the most common form of ulcer. That's a world-class biopharmaceutical result by high school students in a country with no biotech infrastructure working on used equipment. That's the leverage we're talking about today. That's significant.
Stan, we're not going to solve all this in this hour, but just let us understand the timetable you see things on. If we wanted to avoid global resource / climate, I don't know, catastrophe, you might say, when would we need to start the rationing you're talking about? And if we don't do that, when do you think it will be imposed upon us by circumstance?
Well, I think we probably should begin it at about 1999. So we're already behind, and it's going to be a struggle to get anything done before it's really too late. Nobody can predict if there will be one big precipitating event. You know, if we start, some people say it's going to be economic collapse and I've often said that too, that the first manifestation will recognize, will think, oh, this is a big economic problem, when really it's a problem with the underlying resources. But time is, as we are hearing more and more, and as we heard with the news this this week, we don't really have time to debate this for very long.
Stan Cox, as he writes in his new book, yells the obscenity in church rationing, and stands by it there. You can read an excerpt of his new book, Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Rationing. It is a thought-provoking exercise at the very least. Joining us today from Wichita, Stan, thank you very much for your time and your work. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Stephen Kotler with us today from Chimayo, New Mexico, journalist and co-author with Peter Diamandis of Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. Stephen, thanks for your thoughts today. Let's talk again soon. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, Tom. Have a great day.
You too. Author of the forthcoming The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. Listeners, tune in tomorrow. We'll talk about the mother of all diversity, nature, and some of her most fantastic creatures and how they are faring right now. On Point is produced by Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Emily Alfin Johnson, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Ali Harrison. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.